Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Kathy Kelly returns with more powerful stories of life on the ground for those on the receiving end of U.S. foreign policy, and for those on the wrong end of U.S. domestic policies, too. I hope you'll stay tuned. Kathy Kelly lives in Chicago when she's not staying in Afghanistan these days. She is a Roman Catholic radical peace activist. She tries to understand what life is like for ordinary people who live in a place that the United States has turned into a war zone. She listens to what these people have to say. She wants the American people to understand what life is like for the other ordinary people in Afghanistan and elsewhere. The U.S. government and its comrade in arms, the corporate media, neither of them wants us to know anything about these people. If we knew, we might demand change. Kelly spoke in Syracuse, New York on October 6th. On last week's show, we heard most of the talk she had prepared. This week we'll hear more. A few minutes of the talk we didn't have time for last time, plus some very interesting commentary Kelly made during the question and answer session. She gives details of the U.S. military's obscene, repeated bombing raids on a hospital in Kunduz, Afghanistan, on October 3rd. She tells of other military atrocities in Afghanistan. Always, it's the innocent civilians who do most of the dying in our wars. Kelly also connects the peace movement with other social movements now gaining force. For instance, the movement to combat police violence. And she starts out telling what she learned from her most recent experience with peaceful protest at a military base, arrest, trial, and 6 months in the slammer. Here is Kathy Kelly.
Last night I was talking with a group of young people at a college in Maine, and the teacher bought the class, and I thought, well, now what are these students going to think, that, you know, they're digging their way into debt to listen to an ex-con who never pays their taxes get up and talk to them? But I do want to start by saying that after we had tried to deliver the loaf of bread at Whiteman Air Force Base, and for me it was really important. I had recently come back from Afghanistan, and you start every meal with a disc of bread. And, you know, these kids can't come and talk to people in the United States about their grievances, but I can, and I could try to represent their grievance. And we assembled peaceably, and we really did believe that we should talk with the commander of the base about how do they help the drone operators distinguish between combatants and non-combatants, and had anybody been killed that day by the weaponized drones? And if somebody decided, I don't want to do this job anymore, how do they get out of that job? We had lots of things to talk with him about, but of course we were escorted off in handcuffs, Georgia Walker and me. And the judge at the trial found us guilty, and he went right into sentencing. And my friends were looking at him, looking over my resume more or less, and they were all kind of putting up six fingers for 6 months. And the prosecutor, he was so earnest. He was a military lawyer. I wish I could find him, because he said something that actually was true. He said, "Your Honor, Miss Kelly is in great need of rehabilitation." And in a way, going into the prison system is the rehabilitation I need, so that I'll recall what our prison system does by separating people for months and years and even over a decade in some cases. And the pain and the anguish that people feel separated from their children and their loved ones, and the squandering of resources. It was very, very important for me to go into the prison and to realize it's a very, very broken system. I mean, kind of symptomatic, emblematic of that. Miss Paula, whose face could have been in a framed oil painting, she was just such an august figure in the prison, white hair and a small braid going down the back of her neck, and soft brown eyes and gold golden skin, and she, however, like most of the women in the prison, did not find it easy to go up three flights of stairs, which was the norm. You dropped your dishes off to be cleaned in the basement, and then you had to go up three flights to where most of us were living. And the elevator always was broken. And there was Miss Paula hauling herself up the stairs, and she had such good humor. At one point, her heart beating and she was sweating, she stopped and she made a joke. She said, "Oh, I'd give my entire month's salary to help fix this elevator system." Well, that would be $6.82. So a few of us said, "Oh yeah, I would too." And I think we had been ready to earn $24. And when you went to work in the morning in the kitchen, the gas leaks in the kitchen showed that that was broken. You'd wake up at 1 o'clock in the morning. The fire alarm system would go off every night from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock in the morning every 5 minutes. I mean, the place was broken down. The system is broken down. There aren't halfway houses to receive people that get early release. It's a broken system. I do have this idea of how do we unshackle ourselves from these systems of war and imprisonment. It's hard to get into the schools. I think that teachers, even university, tenured university professors sometimes, seem anxious about letting ex-cons who never pay their taxes come into their schools. So I get more invitations, I suppose, than many. I don't want to be whining, but I wish there was more of that going on. And so if you can ever encourage people, you know, just give a half hour of your class over to somebody who is wanting to work toward social change or who perhaps has returned from some of the places that we forget about where we're waging wars, like Afghanistan. I really do mean it about the literacy. I think we need a literacy in the stories of the people who can't escape wars that the United States has waged. And the United States may claim it's a war of necessity, but I think these wars have been wars of choice. And when we start to get that literacy, then I think we start to realize that the United States has unleashed a level of chaos and mayhem and destabilization and murder and torture such that it can't be repaired by the United States. It can't be fixed. I think we should pay restitution. We should reconstruct that hospital. We should pay reparations. But I don't think it's up to the United States to decide who would be the upper hand in these terrible civil wars or where a border would be drawn. I look to the day when the United Nations will be restructured and the United States and other groups that have distinguished themselves as warlords wouldn't have such a strong voice in the United Nations. But at the moment, I think it's patently clear, and certainly the bombing of that hospital underscored that. It's clear that the United States is not in a position to be an exemplar of peacemaking. So how do young people, with their idealism and their altruism, begin to understand that? Well, you've got the ROTC and you've got the military recruiters and Dick Keogh, you know, trying mightily to interfere with that terrible process, but they're going into the schools all the time. So if there is some way to insert a peace presence inside the schools, that's, of course, always valuable. And I think that young people wonder about those folks that are out on the streets with the street heat. So I think that's valid and valuable as well. You know, think about the Occupy Project. What was it? It replicated all that vigiling that we've done for decades. How we can help people in concrete ways understand the unity of the various struggles. This past summer, voices walked from Madison, Wisconsin to Volk Field. And we really wanted to make sure that we would get more or less equal play to the reason why we started in Madison. We started in Madison because in that city, a young black man had been gunned down. And it is very similar to the targeted assassination that the drones are accomplishing. racial profiling and signature strikes have a macabre and a terrible commonality. But, you know, in both situations, there are no questions asked. There is no time set aside to detain someone, to ask a few questions, and much less to think about a jury or a trial. And, you know, in our criminal justice system right now, even if you are charged, you have very few chances to go before a jury. But the similarity, the terrible similarity, and, you know, Medea Benjamin has gathered women together whose sons were killed by United States police officers or in some way were killed while in custody, and once every 28 hours, a young person of color in this country is killed while in police custody or by a policeman or by some vigilante group. So Medea and others have asked the mothers, will you come and join with us and talk with us and maybe we can help amplify your voices? And they've asked the mothers, do you know anything about the officer who killed your son? And again, it was a veteran of United States wars in Iraq and in Afghanistan. And I want to say, you know, arms open, welcome those people who come back from these traumatizing and miserable war zones, sometimes maimed, sometimes terribly traumatized. But I think we also have to recognize that when you train people to kill, when you train people to use brute force, that just doesn't click off because they take a plane back into the United States. So to organize our events and then consistently try to figure out how can we reach out and really make this event encompass the cares and concerns of people we know are dealing with very, very similar and terrible realities. And I think when the Witness Against Torture Fast happened this past year in January in Washington, D.C., the hands-off campaign in Washington, D.C. was also planning their events. And so it was very good to watch how people had a joint panel and then really met with one another. Marsha Abadayo-Coleman met with Matt DeLuisio and others from the Witness Against Torture and figured out how we could jointly have a demonstration and nonviolent civil disobedience and really support each other's campaigns. So it takes some concrete, practical dialogue. And sometimes maybe, in a sense, letting go of some of our most important priorities to say we want to, you know, also give attention to and a voice to other people's priorities. I want to say that if we invest a lot of our energy in elections, I think it can be a bit of a distraction from what you're suggesting we need to do, which is to kind of roll up our sleeves and figure out how to solve problems in a communal way. And it's certainly wrongful that we all have to be kind of competing with one another for an ever-shrinking amount of resources while the Pentagon just simply is like a demonic suction cup and takes those resources. And so I think it is important to engage in nonviolent civil disobedience actions that help us bring these realities to whatever extent we can before the media, before the courts, and before the court of public opinion. But I think it's also good to try to talk with the kids as much as possible. I've been impressed. One thing that my young friends in Afghanistan do is they just take a magic marker and they write on the palm of their hand. In fact, I'm going to ask people tonight to do it with me so I can send a picture back to them. They write in their language, bas, or they write enough in English. And then they take a picture of that. And it's just their expression of their own frustration. We've had it. Enough of war and warfare. And so, you know, people certainly don't want children to be used as, you know, political footballs. We want to be careful about that. And yet I wonder if it's not possible to give more expression to the voices of children who basically are children of war living in the poverty circles in the United States. And so maybe, you know, have some of those kids write enough on their hands. And I think it's also important to try to link up as much as possible with the places where people are displaced by wars, particularly I'm thinking about the refugee populations, and to truly welcome the diversity that comes into our communities, and then to eschew the idea that there ever could be such a thing as borders that separate some people that are more worthy than other people. And again, I'll refer to my young friends in Afghanistan. They embroider on a blue scarf. It says border free in English, and then Bedune Mers in their language. But I think keep on cultivating this idea that there's never any point when it would make sense to kill another person over the issue of where a border is drawn, whether it's in a neighborhood in the United States or between countries, or over the issue of which politician has their hand in your pocket. And so amongst young people, to try and cultivate that altruism and that, I think, often instinctive sense they have that we really are all part of one another, that we have more in common with one another than we do with the 1% elites who would rob and thieve and destroy this planet. So anticipating tomorrow that there might be opportunities to interact with the public, walking along or holding a brief vigil in front of St. Joseph's Hospital, how do we clearly express what happened on October 3rd at 2:05 in the morning when United States missiles fired from an aerial fighter jet, a C-130 transport plane outfitted with weapons, fired on the intensive care unit in the hospital building located as part of a 100-yard compound. The Médecins Sans Frontières hospital facilities are quite large. Forget that I said 100 yard, I'm sorry. The size of a football field. There's a mess hall, there's a place for people to use as a dormitory, places for people that are staff people that are outside the actual hospital. But there is one building that is the actual hospital. And very precise, very specific bombing happened in 15-minute intervals on that building and only that building, beginning with the intensive care unit, from 2:05 in the morning until 3:15 in the morning. And as soon as the bombing happened, people immediately worked to notify the authorities in the United States military and the Afghan military and the NATO forces that they were bombing a hospital. But it continued in 15-minute intervals, dropping missiles that exploded and incinerated people in their beds, including patients, and destroyed the hospital completely. They didn't aim for any other part of that collection of buildings other than the actual hospital. To me, there's not really a question about criminality when you think about war, because I believe that the very act of war is criminal. It's a crime against humanity to train other people to pick up weapons and kill other people to resolve a problem. But we do have international law it exists, and I think it's fair for the Doctors Without Borders, who built and sustained that hospital, who trained the staff, who maintained their presence in a very, very frightening and difficult situation before they were bombed. I think it's fair for them to say, this must be investigated, and it's patently obvious that when an airborne vehicle drops bombs on a hospital, this fits the already stipulated norms of what is called a war crime. Now, the United States initially said, well, there was a conflict and there was collateral damage. I find that phrase pernicious, yes. Collateral damage. And again, I want to remind us of the nurse who said words could not describe her horror. It might have been his horror. As patients burned in their own beds, 3 children were killed. 12 hospital staff, 22 people in all. And the entire facility is rendered useless. The United States military then said, well, actually, there were Taliban inside the hospital. And so they were posing a threat to the United States military because there were special forces apparently advising the Afghan forces. But immediately, the Doctors Without Borders staff said, no, our staff have reported that there was no fighting whatsoever happening inside the hospital, that no one inside the hospital was a threat to anyone outside the hospital. And by that time, the United Nations and the Amnesty International and the International Commission of the Red Cross and quite a lot of other people were beginning to circle around the Doctors Without Borders and say, we're with you. Speak up. So then the United States said, okay, that's not what happened. Then the United States military changed the story a third time and said that they were asked to bomb the hospital by the Afghan military, kind of trying to pawn the whole thing off on the but that simply, it doesn't wash at all. I want to just mention the Taliban have no air force, right? The Afghan military right now in the books is subordinate to the United States when it comes to air actions. They're subordinate to the rules of the United States and NATO. So I don't see any way to dodge what seems patently obvious, that a military force engaged in bombing civilians inside of a hospital. Now, how do we awaken concern here in Syracuse? I think strident words may not be the way to win people over, but I think if we could have a presence that would evoke some questions, some curiosity, and then maybe start to, you know, push a little bit with the media, saying this has been in the mainstream news, it's been covered on CNN, it's been covered on NPR, it's been covered by the NBC, and could the Syracuse media cover the concerns of local people who don't want to be involved unquestioningly or unthinkingly in attacks against innocent civilians, setting a precedent that could actually jeopardize the security of people in the United States, because other people all around the world have strong feelings about these kinds of actions. One of my first encounters in Afghanistan was with a young man who said, do Americans care more about noses than human lives? And I said, what kind of question? I just don't understand. And then he helped me understand that at that time, there were a group of people who were part of a striker brigade who had been sent over to Afghanistan, and they got bored. They just were feeling a lot of malaise, I suppose. They'd been trained to kill, and there wasn't anybody to kill. So they started devising a way to involve themselves in killing. They would kill a peasant, drop a weapon on the peasant's corpse, take a picture, and then tell the rest of their division or troops or whatever, we saved everybody, or their squadron, we saved everybody because we got this guy. He was coming at us with a gun, but we killed him first. And then that kind of morphed into, well, wouldn't it be great if we could take trophies back to the United States? And so they started to cut off the body parts and store them in jars. And when one person tried to start to blow the whistle, he was beaten badly, and they became afraid of one another. So that was, my young friend was trying to say to me that when young Aisha's nose had been badly, badly damaged because of an Afghan man attacking her, and her picture went all around the United States and everybody knew this one girl, he was asking, well, don't people care about human life? In the very place where we're looking at Kunduz, there was a time when some oil tankers that were part of a United States and a European military convoy got mired down in kind of a very muddy area. They were stuck. And poor people in any part of the world seeing, you know, big tanks of fuel, mm-hmm. well, why not? And so people came running. And, you know, they had whatever kind of containers they could carry, and they were helping themselves to this fuel that was just kind of stuck there. And a German military commander learned that there were lots of people congregating in a certain area, and so they called in the drone surveillance. They wanted to see, what's this big growing number of people coming, and is it a threat to the German squadron that was based, you know, some distance away. Probably a lot of the people coming to get the oil didn't even know that this group was even there. But they were so anxious about their own security that they called in United States military strikes, aerial bombardments, and upwards of 90 people were killed. Children, mothers, people that just were desperate for fuel. Now, it's kind of macabre, but Voices has kept the Afghan atrocities list going. And we would only list those situations in which United States forces or NATO forces were involved in actually killing other people. We didn't list all the instances of humiliation and torture and disappearances and night raids. We only listed, you know, these people were killed. And then we would try to follow up when the United States military would say, well, you know, it's under investigation. And it leaves the internet. You can't find the follow-up. So if you wanted more of those kinds of stories, it's a long and a difficult list. But I especially recommend an Amnesty International report that came out 2 years ago in the summertime, and it got almost no attention. But it gives 8 case studies of the ways in which the United States forces definitely violated and abused the human rights of Afghan people. And then Physicians for Social Responsibility last summer came out with a report, and they said at least 100,000 people, 100,000 civilians in Afghanistan have been killed since 2001. And it just didn't make a ripple. And they said that it's such a smokescreen for the United States to act as though, well, the problem is, you know, internecine battles or interreligious fighting, and never to reckon with the problem of the United States invading and occupying and bombing and creating such destabilization in the first place. So what kind of intelligence do we need? We don't need the intelligence supplied by the drones that fly overhead, the miles of camera footage being analyzed by Air Force workers who try to establish patterns of life in Afghanistan and see which person might be walking down which road. We need the intelligence that Ellen has suggested, trying to understand the consequences for people who can't escape our wars.
Kathy Kelly, speaking on October 6, 2015. Thanks again to independent public affairs producer Wilton Vaught for the original video recording. Find more of his work at Other Voices, Other Choices. blogspot.com. And you can find an archive of our past shows at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. I am Kenneth Doust, and I thank you for listening to New World Notes. Illegitimi non carborundum. Remember that an injury to one is an injury to all, and please come back again next week. Peace.